you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRS LP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVAO LP Athol, WDJ. Framingham.
Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Monday, July 27th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Herald being read to you by Alicia. Good morning.
Good morning. Morning, everyone. Happy Monday. And here are your stories from today's Boston Herald. Counselor looks to boost police ranks. Flynn, we are dangerously short-staffed, by Grace Sokovich. Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn will move to propose measures related to waiving Boston Police Department residency requirements and allowing retired officers to take shifts as the department faces ongoing staffing challenges. We are dangerously short-staffed by at least 500 police officers, Flynn said Sunday. This is unfair and unhealthy to police officers and their families. The counselor said he would introduce a hearing order to study the proposal to waive residency requirements for police officers willing to transfer to the Boston Police Department from other Massachusetts police departments, as well as a city council resolution to allow retired Boston cops to take opportunities to work paid details. Though a Boston Municipal Court mandate established in 1980 requires the department maintain at least 2,500 sworn officers, as of May, the police department reported they had 2,102 sworn officers, according to State House News Service reporting. The short staffing issue gained public attention after the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association critiqued the administration, saying the department was down about 600 officers, or a third of their workforce, in early July in response to multiple violent incidents. The Boston mayor's office did not respond to a request for comment on the proposals as of Sunday evening. After 13 people were shot on July 4th, Mayor Michelle Wu said the city was working to prevent, to address, to provide support and resources wherever we can, and had had great success recruiting officers over the last several years. Since our administration started, we've had the largest ever police classes graduate from the academy, Wu said on July 6th. Usually there are around 50 to 70 officers per class that have been hired. Our classes were well in the range of 100-plus, starting in the academy and graduating. The state legislature is also currently considering a home rule petition aimed to increase Boston Police Department staffing. H4093 was filed by East Boston Representative Adrian Madaro. The petition bumps the maximum age to take an entrance exam for the city's police academy from 39 to 44 years old. City councilors also pushed forward a probe to examine the Boston Police Department's staffing, retirements, forced overtime, recruitment strategies, and more in April. We need to support and respect police officers, their families, and the public as well, Flynn said of his proposals. The status quo is no longer an option. DOJ not targeting mass with voting monitors. Election integrity should not be controversial, by Colleen Cronin. U.S. Attorney Leah Foley said the Department of Justice isn't targeting Massachusetts by sending election monitors to two Bay State cities in September. This is not a news story for anyone to suggest that Massachusetts is getting targeted by this DOJ for any inappropriate reason. It's just false, Foley said Sunday during an interview on WCVB's On the Record. Federal monitors, who are sent to go to Boston and New Bedford, are also being sent to jurisdictions in Arizona, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Virginia to oversee primary elections. The DOJ has said monitors are part of an effort to increase voter confidence and voting accuracy, something Foley agrees with. We're not doing it to smear the state of Massachusetts, she said. Monitors have been sent to Massachusetts numerous times throughout numerous administrations, she said, adding that monitors are sent to different locations throughout the country and that she'd previously worked as a monitor in Louisiana after Katrina. Trying to make sure that elections are conducted with integrity should not be controversial, Foley said. Asked if voter fraud was an issue in the Commonwealth, Foley replied, whether it's a problem or not,
okay,
I don't
morning.
Think there's any
you
evidence to suggest
to
that it's a rampant problem in Massachusetts.
Radio.
But, she continued,
me,
as federal officials,
no, I can
we
know,
have
I
the
can
obligation
the
to ensure that the public
the
has the confidence that our elections are run competently and with integrity. Foley also spent a portion of the Sunday interview discussing...
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Good.
No,
good.
I don't hear you.
Oh, you can't hear me?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
No. You can hear me, right?
Yes, I can hear you.
I don't hear you. Why don't you go ask Diane to help you?
Yeah. Okay,
so we're having a little technical problem in the interview room, but not here in the control room. At least we don't think so. So we want you to know that you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. We're located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, and feature stories and more. The Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Again, good morning. My name is David. Paul is in the interview room. We're trying to work out his problem. Well,
hold on for 1 second.
Yeah. Okay. We're gonna take a hold here for a minute.
Sorry. All right. So those two are up. This one's down.
Yeah. This is his mic's on. We don't know if we're still broadcasting right now,
you
but
are. Well, no, not this second, but you were.
I think I can hear you now.
And he's on mic one. There should, I don't know why he's hearing.
I can't hear him. Are you, talk a little bit.
I can hear you, no, David.
I'm not hearing him at all.
Huh.
Is there something to talk now?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. I guess, you know what? The headphones were off. The switch was off.
Oh.
And so you were probably talking to the listeners, so you want to hit
yeah.
the... No.
I'll play.
Yeah. Okay. We were having a technical problem. Yeah. It was at the control board. So, but we've got that fixed thanks to, you know, Diane. Okay. You are listening, again, you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible news and community information. We're located in Lowell, Massachusetts, and we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. The Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. I want to now say good morning to Paul. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, David. Good morning, listeners. Beautiful day out there.
Absolutely. And they're starting to take down all of the signs and barricades yep. that they use for this weekend. They're out there in force now.
Oh, yes. I noticed that.
The lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and the Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. So, Paul, how about you leading off with today's Lowell Sun?
Okay, and as you just mentioned, it was just the conclusion of the Lowell Folk Festival, and there's a small article here, front page news, concerning that. And it says, headline is, Lowell Folk Festival's 39th year, a smash hit. And there was great weather, which there was, big crowds, and the celebrating music, food, and the city's 200th birthday. And there's a picture here, a very bright big picture of the Boarding House Park stage, which is a popular venue for this festival. The 39th Lowell Folk Festival was one for the record books, with great weather and big crowds that lingered even as the three-day event started winding down on Sunday evening. The festival had, as John Carolan of Lowell said, a really great vibe. "The weather has been so nice," Carolan said, "everybody seems happy." He attended his 39th festival with his nephew Chris, who is on festival number 4. Carolan's wife is Greek, so he said he was partial to the Greek food in the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox tent in JFK Plaza behind City Hall. But like many attendees, the duo sampled the cuisine available from at least 15 different nations. Most of the time, I try new food, Chris said. And the Laotian and Filipino tents had really good food, he says. They were making their way over to Merrimack Street from the Boarding House Park stage area to listen to some music before heading to Market Street and JFK Plaza for more food. And they both said they were looking forward to Folk Festival 40. Over at the Rockland Trust Bank Dance Pavilion, Erica Robinson and her son Ryan were enjoying the Zydeco music of the Gino Della Fosse and French Rock and Boogie Band. The 12-year-old said he came for the egg rolls. "It's not my first festival, but I'm glad I came for the food," he said. His mom agreed that the diverse food was a big reason her family enjoys the festival. But the music and the chance to catch up with people was another bonus. "You can't walk 2 feet without seeing someone you know," she said. "It's a nice event." Even performers picked up on the festival's welcoming scene. In the tent behind the Saab Family Foundation stage at Market Street, Melissa Carper was tuning her upright bass. And although she has played other folk festivals, this was her first appearance at Lowell's signature event, playing classic country with Emily Gimble. They also played at Boarding House Park and at the Richard K. and Nancy L. Donahue stage at St. Anne's Church, which is right across the street here off Merrimack Street. "The audiences have been wonderful," she said. And as closing time at 6 p.m. ticked closer, Arthur Artie Sutcliffe, chairman of the Lowell Festival Foundation, was driving around in a golf cart with Greater Lowell Community Foundation President Jay Linehan, checking in on vendors and festival goers. He had been going strong since the festival opened 48 hours earlier with the parade of flags on Friday evening. "I'm washed," he said, laughing. "I'm glad we can do it. People are so happy here." Both men said they felt the festival offers not only food and music, but also a sense of community. "There's absolutely a vibe in the air where everybody is enjoying it," Linehan said, noting that the festival is a break from all the craziness in the world. "It's a chance to get away from all that." The volunteers of Jack Moynihan and Carrie Brenner at the Lowell Folk Festival Information Center, let me just turn a page, wrap this up, booth at City Hall Plaza, said they had more out-of-towners come to their booth than in past years. "I think it's because the city is celebrating its 200th birthday," Moynihan said. And as the performers finished their sets, the crowd seemed reluctant to pack up and leave. "Only 365 more days until Lowell Folk Fest 2027. So, sounds like a good day was had by all.
And you said it was the
39th.
Wow. Mm. That's a long time.
Yeah, it's good.
Mm. Okay. I'm going to read Sunday's Lowell Sun. And the lead article at the top of the fold excuse me, says canal to be refilled despite previous issues. And then below it in smaller print, it says the new $418 million Lowell High School runs parallel to the waterway. I have to repeat that number, $418 million to renovate a school.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem like a lot of money to you? It does to me. That's a half, almost a half a billion dollars. I could have built, you know, give me open land. I could build a beautiful one for probably half that number.
Yeah, but it's for the urban inner-city population.
Well, you know there's such thing as bus transportation, right?
Yeah, well, I think that this has been discussed before. There might have buses that would take, and traffic problems. Every time you think you have a good idea, there's always...
Well, I always have good ideas, you know.
There's always negatives.
But you always seem to find the downside to it. So, okay. All right, so that's, and, you know, that's why we rebuilt the Lowell High School and paid $418,000. The problems that we have, we keep.
Yes, I guess that's...
Okay, so this is coming out of Lowell, but this is about the canal that runs parallel to the high school. So it says here, for now, the Merrimack Canal, which runs through the east and west campuses of the $400 million high school. It's hard for me to pronounce $418 million. To rebuild and renovate project is dry. Okay? The canal is dry, so you can't go fishing there. Which runs from Merrimack to Middlesex Streets is filled with cattails and other vegetation. But the time students return to school on September 2nd, so that's after Labor Day, right? So September 2nd. Yeah. The city's construction project manager said the project team plans to refill the waterway with water, despite visibly deteriorating infrastructure. Oh, no. Oh, no. We're going to have to rebuild the sidewalls. Oh, here we go. Despite visibly deteriorating infrastructure, including masonry that displays cracks, gaps, and spalling, S-P-A-L-L-I-N-G. I have no idea what that word is. We had run into some water, whether it was relative to the canal or not. It's hard to say, but with keeping it down, we haven't had any water issues at all into the building. Well, that's because you don't have any water in the canal. Oh, can you imagine the headlines? The building gets flooded because we refilled the canal. Can you? I'm predicting that.
Yeah, that's a wait and see. Let's see what happens.
You know, and then I'm going to come up again and say, couldn't we put it somewhere else? And then you'll tell me something else would have come up. Okay. The almost six-year construction took them 6 years. Project was designed by the architect firm of Perkins Eastman, is being built by Suffolk. I have to go to page 8. By Suffolk, it must be Suffolk Construction.
Yeah.
Where is page 8? Okay, 8. Come on, 8. Don't be hard on my fingers. Okay. Construction and overseen by Skanska, the owner's project manager that represents the city's interest. Part of the price tag includes $36 million cost overrun. Wouldn't you like to have that in your pocket, the $36 million, just the overrun? That was the result of structural issues with the renovation of the basement slab in the 1922 building that in turn delayed the project timeline by an entire year. The slab repairs to the 1892 Coburn Hall building, which had its own basement issues, are built into that overall figure. On the west side, canal runs along the renovated 1980s building and the new cafeteria. On the east side, the canal borders Lucy Larcom Park, the 1922, and the Coburn Hall buildings. Skanska project manager Jim Dowd told the city council in December that the 1922 slab was unstable due to soil settling under the concrete, a condition that was not found during the initial site inspection. The cause of the settling was not disclosed. Okay. But to mitigate potential water infiltration issues. Kane told the committee, Suffolk is installing drains in the perimeter walls of both buildings. We had talked about the end of August to open up the canal gates after Suffolk works on the foundation drainage. That's the hardest part, and by that time, we should have a slab done in the basement and the foundation drainage, too. Other water concerns were addressed. Why would you bring water in? Do we need to have it in these side canals?
I don't know. I suppose it's a look, isn't it? Water looks better than weeds.
Looks. Oh, no. Wait a minute. Let me. You are a homeowner. Would you have to have a moat around your house with water or with some weeds? At least you know you can go and pick out the weeds. Mm-hmm. But the water, it infiltrates everything.
Yes, it does.
So, other water concerns were addressed at the June school building meeting, including a kitchen pipe leak. The committee member, Bill Samaras, said took out an electrical panel.
Oof.
In another instance, a drain pipe backed up and caused flooding issues. I don't want water near my house. I don't want it near any building. With the water drained from the canal, the exposed masonry shows various stages of deterioration, including large gaps between stones and concrete. When contacted by the Sun for comment on the condition of the canal and its impact on the construction project, Kane said the Lowell High School project scope does not include any work on the canal. How much is it going to cost me now to fix the canal? The Lowell National Park maintains that nearly 6 miles of canal walkways and operates guided boat walking tours of the Pawtucket Canal, the oldest, but whatever, blah, blah, blah. But the National Park Service's jurisdiction does not extend to the operation of the canals themselves. Their Merrimack Canal, she said, is owned by Boot Hydropower, whose parent company is Maryland-based Hull Street Energy. For reference, please see page 27 of the Resources Ownership Boundaries and Land Rights Study Report that you can find under the document section. A spokesman for Hull Energy said Boot Hydropower has been coordinating with the city on the Lowell High School project to ensure safe, successful construction of the project. We would defer questions on the Merrimack Canal and its impact to the project to the city vice president and external affairs, Natalie Joubert. By phone last week, Assistant City Manager Sean Machado said the foundation drains are expected to address any water issues related to the canals. The Lowell High School project is the largest capital investment in the city's history. It was approved in 2016 and is funded in part by the Massachusetts School Building Authority by almost $250 million, leaving the city responsible for up to $170 million. The debt service on the project amounts to 1.6% of the total proposed 4.6% tax increase in fiscal 2027. Taxpayers will continue to absorb the cost of the overruns for a total project cost. Are they saying how long you're going to be paying for this thing? They don't. You and I won't live long enough for it to be paid off. Okay, Paul?
Yep.
By fiscal 2024, this share has increased to more than 23%. I don't know what that is. The next Lowell's School Building Committee meeting is scheduled to take place on Thursday, July 30th. All I know is if I was on this committee, I would have said we're not doing it in the inner city, okay? We're going to bus it, and you can call me and tell me when the buses don't run, then we got a problem.
But, yeah.
You know, and I would have done it for $200 million less.
I think I smell a lawsuit against the construction company for not noticing the...
Oh, you know, the canal, and then, you know.
Well, you never know. The perimeter drain that's being installed might take care of the water. We'll know in a few years.
Yeah, whoever is the contractor to fix the canal, he's going to make a lot of money because I have a feeling it's going to cost.
But it's
a
not
going.
The point is, it's not going to get fixed because they're going to fill it full of water before the high school starts. Oh, it sounds like a shambles.
Oh, so now you're coming around to what I was thinking, that we should have built it somewhere else.
I think that would have a... It's like Diane, not Diane.
Well, you know the Market Basket on the Tewksbury Low Line, right? Is that on 38?
Yeah.
It wasn't that some talk about putting it there?
Yeah, with the football stadium.
Yeah. You know, I think that would have been...
But like Elizabeth pointed out, a lot of people who go to Lowell High School are from the immediate inner city and from all the way out where the river is and the boulevard is and all that. So how are you going to... How many buses and how much headache is that going to cost the city to go to the Tewksbury direction? It has serious problems doing that.
All right. Well,
in my opinion, when the
moat around Lowell High School is filled with alligators in the summer, then you'll come around. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Time will tell.
Time will tell.
Here's another story, front page story about, and it involves a canal, and it's kind of a sad, very sad story. This one, I think. And it says the investigation continues into a Chelmsford man who was found in a canal. And his mother says she spoke to Gavin Saab the morning that he vanished. Where 22-year-old Gavin Saab was during the days he was missing and how he ended up in the Western Canal in Lowell remains unclear, as authorities say the circumstances surrounding his death are under investigation. Megan Kelly, a spokesperson for the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, said on Friday that the probe into Saab's disappearance and how he entered the water is ongoing. She added that the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner is working to determine the cause and manner of his death. Saab's mother, Maria Saab, said she last spoke to her son on Monday morning and that he was fine. He was leaving work, she said, adding that, as of now, nobody can say where he was in the hours and days that followed. The Chelmsford Police Department announced in a social media post that Gavin, a Chelmsford resident and a 2021 graduate of Neshoba Valley Technical High School in Westford, was last seen in the area of Appleton Street in Lowell at about 5 p.m., on Monday, which must mean last Monday. An individual conducting a water study spotted Gavin's body in the Western Canal and called 911 about 11:40 a.m. Thursday, according to an emergency broadcast. His body was recovered by members of the Lowell Fire Department shortly after. Witnesses to the recovery said firefighters launched their boat over a fence that lines the walking path along the Western Canal, which runs beside Suffolk Street. A woman who lives on Suffolk Street near the recovery site said from her doorstep on Thursday evening that she watched the firefighters launch their boat, and she pointed out that she had not heard or seen anything unusual in the area of the canal the night before or in the morning. In the morning, I was sitting there, she said, pointing to a bench along the canal, and if I would have walked further down, I would have seen the body. In the meantime, Saab's family is preparing for a funeral service and a celebration of life for Gavin, and has launched a GoFundMe on Friday to help cover the costs. The fundraiser, created by Gavin's aunt, Kim Perry, set a goal of $14,000 and had raised more than $11,000 as of Saturday afternoon. Perry wrote in the fundraiser post that she was reaching out with a heavy heart after Gavin passed away unexpectedly at 22 years old, leaving our family devastated and searching for answers. He was found in a river canal and the circumstances surrounding his passing are still unknown, she said. We were not prepared for this unimaginable loss and it has shaken us to our core. She described Gavin as a bright spirit from childhood, always full of love and joy, who grew into a beautiful young man with the biggest heart making everyone around him feel cared for and cherished. Gavin had a special gift for bringing light and laughter into any situation, whether times were tough or easy, Perry said. He was my sister's first son, my precious nephew, and the first child I was trusted to babysit. We shared countless memories growing up together, and he touched the lives of so many as an amazing son, grandson, nephew, uncle, and cousin. If Gavin ever touched your heart, you know it was special and unforgettable. So, sad story there.
Yeah. Okay, back to the Sunday Lowell Sun front page. It says Bill Ricca passes chief search policy. And then it says below it, that's despite town council advising it's unenforceable. So, again, this is coming out of Bill Ricca. The Bill Ricca Select Board voted 4-1 Monday to approve a policy to prioritize internal candidates when it comes to hiring a new police or fire chief, despite guidance from two town councils that such a policy may not be enforceable under the charter. The policy was placed on the agenda after officials were made aware earlier this month that town manager Chris Dillon was opening up the search for a new fire chief to external candidates. While some preferred to keep it an internal search within the Billerica Fire Department. In January, Fire Chief Robert Cole gave a one-year notice of his retirement. And earlier this month, the application period started for the position. Most of the select board and the firefighters union for Billerica Fire Department subsequently released statements to express their disappointment in the move, leading to the creation of a new policy. The hiring policy would require the town manager to prioritize internal candidates for a new police or fire chief, except for, I have to go to page 7, except for a situation where there is a vacancy while there are no eligible candidates within the respective departments. During Monday's meeting, though, town attorney Brian Bertram advised the board the policy wouldn't necessarily be illegal, but that under the charter, the town manager would not be required to abide by it. I fully respect and think it's perfectly appropriate for the SB to look at the values that are in the policy of the importance of internal candidates, of those being factors that are worthy of consideration, particularly in a fire department this large. But ultimately, he opined on this legal issue here, which is the division of powers in the charter. And while others may disagree with it, when we look at not just the statement of the select board, but those of the town manager is the chief administrative officer of the town. He is in charge of the town. He is in charge of personnel. Under specific provisions we are talking about, he is the appointing authority. The lawyer continued, the select board has a role. You can reject a proposed appointment, but you are not the appointing authority under the charter. When we look at this, we believe this does fall under the administrative day-to-day operations, at least until the point where the select board is noticed. Later in the meeting, while responding to questions about the board, the attorney said that the board could pass the policy, but that the town manager doesn't have to follow it at that point. To the extent it tells him how to discharge his duties under the charter, I would say it is at best non-binding and an expression of the select board's will, but not something that he has to follow. Most of the board disagreed with the lawyer's legal opinion. We obviously want the best qualified candidate, and I think it would be tough to argue by anybody that we would find a better quality candidate than somebody that is internal, whether it be for the police department or fire department, said the board member Michael Rosa. Board member Jillian Pavitas said she is in favor of hiring internally for the fire chief position because it can serve as a motivator for firefighters and would be good for morale. I also think the job itself, whether it's to be the fire department or police, is certainly different from other town hall positions. And I think a lot of the trust that has to go into that type of role like that, having someone that is their leader that they respect and have worked alongside, literally trusting them with their life in some cases. Board member Dina Ferreira argued that the day-to-day operations is not defined in the town charter and that the policy does not appoint anyone. It does not remove the town manager's authority. It does not interfere with the town manager's ability to evaluate candidates. It simply establishes that the town's policy is that qualified internal candidates should be given first opportunity to advance into leadership positions within our policy in the fire department. Dylan said during the meeting that his belief is that he is hired by the board but expected to carry out what is in the best interest for the residents. In his prior experience as town manager in the other communities, he said the fire department saw a better outcome when the search was opened up than when it was made to only look at internal candidates. In the first instance, when doing an internal search, Dylan said he ended up choosing a qualified fire department chief who did well and got the department through the COVID-19 pandemic, but who struggled with discipline. There was a struggle where they came up with their coworkers and separating themselves from being management from the fact that they were all their friends they used to go drinking with. Let's face it, the fire department, they are a family. And at that time, that individual had a hard time recognizing that something he had to do, potentially discipline, and to do certain things. In the second fire chief hiring process Dylan was part of, he said the search was opened up beyond fire department employees. Ultimately, the town hired another chief from within the department, but Dylan said he was glad they went through the full process because he and the fire department found ways to improve from it. In fact, one of the things I learned from basically the runner-up was something that they did on some calls. I then talked to the chief after he was appointed and was modified how he handled certain situations because he brought something up where we weren't necessarily doing best practice, said Dylan. If nothing more, you can learn through the process how to improve what we do. I don't know about this. How this is written. Select board member Daniel O'Connor was among the board members to make a statement earlier this month in support of hiring an internal candidate, but after seeing town council's legal opinion, he was the only member to vote against the new policy. I want to be clear. I support hiring from within. Without a doubt, we have great firefighters here in Billerica, and I hope the next leader of the Billerica Fire Department is promoted from within the department. Our firefighters know this community. They know the residents. They serve on a daily basis. They have earned the trust of our town. They know our roads, and they should have every opportunity to lead the department they have dedicated to their careers. At the same time, this board and the town managers have responsibilities. I want to make sure I am following the civil service laws and the town charter to a T. While I do agree with the spirit and the intent of the introduced policy, in its current form, it is not legal.
I'm not sure.
I get you want to hire from within. I get it.
Yeah, it's like climb up the ladder and get the top job,
yep,
I guess.
I get it. I get it. All right. Turn back to you, Paul.
All right. So this is a local news thing, and it's about elections, of course, which are never out of the news. And the headline is Working Hard to Educate Voters. And it says an all-party primary November ballot question advances. Local people have been involved in a grassroots campaign to get a question on the November ballot dealing with primary elections garnered enough signatures to do just that, and they held a celebration in Boston. This past fall, Will Goldsmith and Ajayi Harris of Coalition for Healthy Democracy, along with many others, gathered 100,000 signatures from registered voters in the state to get the all-party primary initiative on the ballot, which would eliminate political party primaries for state elections. This initiative would change how we run Massachusetts primary elections for statewide and federal congressional offices, Goldsmith said. Right now, voters are familiar with the party split of the ballots in primaries, and the winner of each separate primary will face each other in the general election. Under this new proposed system, there would only be a single ballot that all candidates appear on, regardless of party affiliation, and every voter would see that one ballot. And the two candidates with the most votes would move on to the general election. Goldsmith got on board with this ballot question after hearing about it from a friend. I looked into the initiative as enthusiastic to get involved once I saw what it was all about. I always have thought that the two-party control over the system has not incentivized voters, especially, of course, the 65,000 unenrolled voters in Massachusetts. I want to get more young people out voting. They canvassed on this issue in the local region. It sounds especially like in mid-state, around Holden, Leominster, and Townsend, and across the rest of the state. As a result, they were successful in getting the two rounds of signatures required for ballot questions and found out that the all-party primary proposal would be question three on the ballot. We tried a grassroots approach by activating volunteers in different areas to get the signatures. And I personally canvassed in Fitchburg, and we turned in signatures from over 300 of the 351 different cities and towns in the state. The Worcester resident wants to give a big shout out to members of Fitchburg State University Students for a Democratic Society. They did a great job helping us out in early May, he said. And this student-led group attended the third No Kings rally downtown Fitchburg on March. And adding that their president, Adam Quinlan, was at their June 30th turn-in event at the State House in Boston. Coalition for Healthy Democracy Outreach Director Bella Santos of Woburn has helped with the election reform project and was part of the team who organized the turn-in event in honor of people who helped us gather signatures and tell the community about the ballot initiative. We did a brief rally together with our volunteers in front of the State House, turned in the signatures, and then headed over to Democracy Brewing afterwards for a celebration with food and shout-outs and mingling with other people. Fitchburg Mayor Sam Squalia has officially endorsed their initiative. As an independent mayor representing a gateway city, I know that real progress comes when all of us have an opportunity to take a seat at the table. I support an election system that rewards diversity of thought, coalition building, accountability, and broad community support. Voters deserve a process that is more open, more competitive, and more reflective of the people they elect leaders to serve. Now that they surpassed the signatures by a large margin, putting it on the ballot, Goldsmith said they are pivoting to voter outreach through summer and early fall to ensure that people are familiar with and educated on this issue. Ballot questions, especially with how many were petitioned for this year, can cause a lot of confusion. So it's now our job to make sure we're talking with people of all local levels and answering all of their questions. And now they've been assigned a ballot question, they're working hard to educate voters so that it passes in November. The changes that it will bring could really start Massachusetts in the right direction of dealing with rises like housing, affordability and transportation that so many of us deal with, he said, of what could happen if this primary ballot question is approved. We have broad support from voters all across the state, and I hope that we can all come together to really make change. So, big issue these days, elections.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, here's a follow-up to the article about looking for a police chief or a fire chief.
Follow-up.
In Billerica, okay? And doing an internal search. It says, Billerica welcomes three new homegrown officers. I don't know what that means.
Oh, the police department, yeah. Okay.
Let's see what homegrown means. Three new officers, all with deep roots in town, have joined the Billerica Police Department after graduating this month from the Municipal Police Training Committee Randolph Police Academy. The new officers, William James Curra, Joseph Chase, and Adam Kearns, are ready to serve and protect after being sworn in by the town clerk, Sandra Gore, on Monday. The Billerica Police Department announced in a press release, Curra, who moved from Tewksbury to Billerica. People live in Tewksbury?
Yeah, you know.
To go to Billerica?
Probably cheaper housing.
As a teenager and graduated from Billerica Memorial High School, earned his MPTC Randolph Police Academy Academic Achievement Award for finishing first in his class. Well, that's pretty good. Before entering policing, Kerr worked in security, customer service, and finance at the former Linway Auto Auction. Later, I have to go to page four. Later, America's Auto Auction of Boston. He also spent several years in commercial moving and holds a commercial driver's license. Okay, that's cool. Chase, a lifelong Billerica resident and a Billerica Memorial High School graduate, played varsity ice hockey and continued competing for 2 years after high school. He worked 6 years as a construction laborer before entering the academy. Okay. It's always been a lifelong goal of mine to work in law enforcement, and I am honored to be able to serve the community. Okay, that's cool. Kearns, also a Billerica native. You think these three guys got appointed because they're all Billerica guys, right?
Well, it helps, I think, because you know the community.
Graduated from the masonry program at Shawshin Valley Technical High School, where he played soccer and baseball. He later earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Roger Williams University in Bristol, Rhode Island, minoring in psychology and political science. He also completed internships with two police departments. I am excited to come back to my hometown to engage with the community and keep the town safe, Kern said. Police Chief Roy Frost said the department is proud to welcome three officers who grew up in town. The Billerica Police Department is proud of its deep roots in our community, and we are pleased to welcome three qualified men who grew up in our town to the department, he said. I look forward to seeing where these men will go in their careers and all the ways in which they will serve the community. So, yeah, that's a nice article.
Yep. Yeah, you know.
So they're starting out their careers in police work. All right, I'll turn it back to you, Paul.
All right, so let's see. I got the local news segment here. Two stories, very different from one another, and I'll read the scary one first, I guess. And it says that a New Hampshire woman has been charged after police find a dog and puppies in a hazardous garage. And the police discovered trash, exposed wiring, and gasoline near some bedding. A Hudson woman is facing animal cruelty charges after police say a dog and her seven newborn puppies were found living in dangerous conditions inside a detached garage. The Hudson Police Department said the discovery that led to the arrest of 50-year-old Candace Riley came after an animal control officer and a patrol officer responded to a residence on May 31st following repeated complaints about persistent dog barking. Inside the garage, police allegedly found a cane corso, it must be a dog, I'm not aware of it, that had recently given birth along with her litter of seven puppies. According to police, the animals were surrounded by trash debris, exposed electric wires, batteries, deteriorating drywall, and an open container of gasoline placed right near their food and water bowls. And the puppies were, of course, I imagine, were allegedly resting on several soiled blankets. Animal control determined that the mother and puppies needed to be removed immediately due to these unsafe conditions. And a follow-up investigation later found that the dog had originally delivered 10 puppies, but three did not survive. Police said Riley was not at the residence when the animals were taken, but was later identified as the legal owner. Police obtained an arrest warrant and took her into custody on Wednesday at her Hudson home without incident. The address of the residence where the dogs were kept was not released by police. Riley is being charged with 8 counts of cruelty to animals, all what are called Class A misdemeanors. I'm not sure what that is. She was released on personal recognizance and is scheduled to appear in court on the 9th. On Tuesday, that's tomorrow, at Nashua District Court. In a press release announcing this, the Hudson Police Department thanked the Animal Rescue League of New Hampshire for assisting with care and rehoming of these animals. And the other shorty one here is a more bright story, shall we say. It comes out of Worcester. And the Better Business Bureau of Central New England and its Consumer Education Foundation have announced the 5 recipients of the 2026 Barbara J. Sinnott Student of Integrity Scholarship. Now in its 12th year, this annual scholarship honors high school seniors who exemplify ethical leadership, integrity, and a commitment to their communities. Core values championed by the late Barbara J. Sinnott, former president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Central New England. This is a highly competitive process of 110 applicants, and each one of these will receive a scholarship of $1,000 to further their education. I will give their names. Reed O'Hanesian, Elizabeth Matheson, Estelle Baden, Benjamin Goodrow, and Isabella Soteropoulos. I also believe that volunteerism builds character through integrity and empathy, says O'Hanesian. Through some of my volunteering experiences, I've learned to appreciate how different people's circumstances can be. Working at the local food pantry, Loaves and Fishes, I realize that many people struggle with poverty and food insecurity, and it feels good to serve my community and bring some relief. It also makes me appreciate my own good fortune, so I aim to live my life with honesty and generosity. I became a patrol leader where I was able to mentor younger scouts to step outside their comfort zones and build a character in the ways I once had, says Elizabeth Matheson of Quabbin Regional High School. I was able to foster an environment that not only challenged the younger scouts, but me as well to become the best versions of ourselves and try new things together. Scouting taught me that the most important parts of character building doesn't come from focusing on yourself. It comes from encouraging others to challenge themselves in as many ways as possible. So there are some good young people out there, David.
Okay. All right. Now, before we take our break, I would assume in your paper also, Rosie's Diner has been advertising.
Yeah.
And yet, I had to look up their address because it doesn't list it. It's in Chelmsford.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, but because here's a half a page advertisement for Rosie's Diner, and it's listing some of their signature specials.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And yet...
And they didn't give an address, right?
They don't give an address. So, okay, but I picked out one of the signature specials for you, Paul.
Okay.
All right, you want to hear it?
I will listen, yes.
Okay, S'mores Waffle. S'mores Waffle. Okay, a Belgian waffle with warm marshmallow fluff, crushed graham crackers, chocolate chips, and whipped cream, finished with a marshmallow drizzle. I could see you going back every day for a week to get that.
I would not eat that if you paid me.
You wouldn't eat that?
No.
I wouldn't either. Okay. All right. Should I do a quick one here?
Yeah, well, how about reading another one of the
One of the signature?
Choices?
Oh, okay. Well, all right, I'll give you the names, and then you tell me if you're interested in hearing the detail. Brussels sprout hash.
I like Brussels sprouts.
Oh, okay. My wife gets that. I cannot eat it. I can't. Okay, all right, I'm going to read it to you. So it's hash, Brussels sprouts hash. Ooh. Homemade maple vinaigrette, feta cheese.
No.
Okay. Sambal, red onion, Brussels sprouts, poached eggs, and chopped bacon. Not all of it, right?
Mm.
Avocado toast.
I like avocado.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were just kind of a Irish meat and potatoes guy.
Oh, no. I eat all kinds of food.
You're a gourmet eater. Two slices of toasted multigrain bread covered with avocado, grilled tomatoes, baby spinach, a sprinkle of sea salt, and a side of home fries. Add one egg cooked to the style of your choice.
That sounds good.
All right. So look it up. Rosie's Diner.
We have to go there.
How about caramel French toast?
Being a diabetic, that's not a good choice.
How about the lumberjack?
Ooh.
Two eggs cooked any style, wheat or white bread, two sausage links, two slices of bacon, home fries, and your choice of two pancakes or two slices of jumbo French toast.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. You won't have to eat for a whole day after
that.
Does
it give a price on those?
Yes. $16. I'd pay that just to see you eat all that. So, all right. I guess we're going to take a breakfast break, right?
Yep, breakfast.
All right, so we want you to know that you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Paul and I will take a 15-minute break at 11:15. We will be back reading the local Lowell Sun newspapers, yesterday's and today's. And for now, I'm switching you back to Marshfield Broadcasting. Bye-bye for now.
Trained and told to do.
It could be for anything. Helping a friend move.
Listening to a fellow veteran for hours at any hour of the day.
Or just simply making time for people. A neighbor, a loved one, or even a stranger.
We're often the first to help others. There's no question about it.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
Perhaps it's time to do for yourself what you would do for others.
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Some people won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is often laced into illicit drugs and used to make fake versions of prescription pills. You can't see it, taste it, or smell it. Suppliers mix fentanyl into their products because it's potent and cheap, and the dealer might not even know. Keep yourself and others safe by knowing the real deal on fentanyl. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRS Middleborough, WRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJ. And Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello and good morning. My name is Susan. Today is Monday, July 27th, 2026. I'll be reading today for the Talking Information Center, and I'll be reading the Washington Post. And here's our first story. The Post counted 70 deaths from July heat domes. The true total may not be known. Epidemiologists say the country's slow, sometimes haphazard approach to assessing heat mortality makes that a dramatic undercount. Martha Irene Van Egmond was working in her garden in Bolton, Mississippi, when she stumbled and couldn't get up. The 83-year-old spent hours lying on the ground amid temperatures over 90 degrees, the county coroner said, eventually succumbing to the oppressive heat. Mike Rodriguez, 57, died of heat stroke in his poorly ventilated attic apartment on Chicago's south side, neighbors told local public radio station WBEZ, his core body temperature rising so high his organs could no longer function. In a small town south of Philadelphia, a 68-year-old man stepped inside his home after trimming his hedges and immediately collapsed. The county coroner attributed his death to a heart attack triggered by heat exhaustion. These are three among at least 69 people who died from the extreme temperatures that beset the United States at the beginning of July, according to the Washington Post survey of health departments, medical examiners' records, and local news reports. That figure puts the heat wave on par with some of the deadliest weather events of the 21st century, exacting a direct toll more than twice that of the 2025 Los Angeles fires, which killed 31, and more than Hurricane Harvey's 68 deaths in 2017. At least one person died in a later heat dome that stretched from Montana to Wisconsin in the middle of the month. But the preliminary death count from both of these events probably underestimates the true impact of this summer's heat, experts say, exposing the shortcomings of the United States' slow and sometimes haphazard approach to assessing deaths from extreme temperatures. Most states rely on official death certificates, which can take weeks to be issued and often fail to identify heat as a contributing factor. These are mass mortality events, said Christy Ebby, an epidemiologist at the University of Washington Center for Health and Global Environment. Quote, but when we don't know the numbers and people can't see it, it's hard on an individual level to understand that heat is deadly. Many European countries, by contrast, assess deaths from extreme temperatures by using an approach known as excess mortality analysis, which was also widely used during the height of the coronavirus pandemic. This method uses statistical analysis to assess how many more people died in a given period than would have been expected under normal circumstances, then estimates which portion of those deaths are attributed to the heat. European officials have attributed more than 10,000 excess deaths to the continent's record-breaking June heat wave. Quote, we're falling behind Europe in protecting population health during extreme heat events, end quote, said Joan Casey, an environmental epidemiologist at the University of Washington, who used the excess mortality method to analyze deaths from a 2021 heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. Quote, the methods are fairly standard, and we have the capability to do this, she said. We just need to make the collective decision that we think it's important for us to understand this in real time. To assess the death toll from the two heat domes that descended on the United States this July, The Post contacted the health departments for every state where the National Weather Service issued an extreme heat warning. Of the 31 agencies the Post contacted, 9 said it would take them weeks or months to analyze death records from this event. 4 did not respond to information requests in time for publication, and 2 states, Ohio and Wyoming, said they did not track heat-related mortality. The states that did provide data emphasized that their numbers are preliminary. Most deaths from the 2 heat waves occurred in New Jersey, where officials say an estimated 29 people died from heat-related causes. But that doesn't mean the state suffered worse heat or was less prepared to protect people, Eby said. It's possible that even more deaths occurred elsewhere, but have yet to be identified. These fatalities were connected to some of the most extreme temperatures on record. Locations in more than 24 states matched or exceeded their previous all-time highs during the heat domes. Millions of people sweltered through temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit for multiple days in a row. Researchers at the World Weather Attribution Network, which conducts rapid studies to determine how climate change influenced weather events, found that the torrid combination of heat and humidity in the early July event would have been, quote, virtually impossible, end quote, in a world not warmed by greenhouse gas pollution. Those conditions put immense strain on the human body. The heart will begin to pump harder, pushing blood just below the surface of the skin where it can shed heat more easily. Heavy sweating will kick the kidneys into high gear so they can conserve more water. If the body is unable to keep a person's core temperature within healthy limits, it can trigger a cascade of organ failure that eventually proves deadly. Quote, but if we are focusing only on heat stroke, that's just the tip of the iceberg, said Gary Fallos Konstantinoudos, an epidemiologist at Imperial College London who studies climate impacts on health. If a person suffers from a chronic illness, such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes, the stress of keeping cool can trigger a heart attack or dangerous blood sugar swings. Prolonged exposure to extreme temperatures can also exacerbate respiratory and kidney conditions with potentially fatal consequences. In these cases, the person responsible for filling out a victim's death certificate, typically a physician, coroner, or medical examiner, often focuses on the most immediate cause of death without mentioning environmental factors, Eby said. In many states, coroners are elected officials, she added, and may not have the medical training necessary to recognize when heat causes a heart attack, kidney failure, or other fatal conditions. That means when United States health officials look through medical records to assess mortality from a heat wave, they are missing a broad array of indirect deaths triggered by the high temperatures, Eby said. The painstaking process of gathering and analyzing death certificates can also lead to a long lag time before the public learns a disaster's true death count and makes it difficult to compare mortality across states. In Maryland, where officials have attributed at least 19 fatalities to the early July heat dome, determining heat death relies on a comprehensive investigative process that considers scene findings, the person's medical history, and a post-mortem examination, said Department of Health spokesperson David McAllister. McAllister contrasted that process with relatively simpler tasks of assessing whether someone drowned in a flood or suffered trauma from hurricane damage. Quote, heat-related deaths can be more difficult to definitively identify because heat often acts as a physiologic stressor, he wrote in an email. Because so many deaths from extreme heat go unrecognized, the phenomenon is often called a silent killer, Konstantinoudis said. It sounds cheesy, he said, but we say this because it's very hard to get a complete picture. That's where excessive mortality analysis comes in. They cannot define precisely who died because of the heat, experts say, and should not replace more detailed methods. But these analyses can be performed more quickly, and they can reveal deaths that remain hidden when officials rely only on death certificates. In Europe, Konstantinoudis said, Officials have widely adopted the excess deaths approach to provide real-time mortality estimates during extreme events. Spain's leading public health agency, for example, publishes daily estimates of heat deaths based on temperature data and statistical models. The French government reported approximately 1,000 excess deaths while the June heat wave was still ongoing. Within 3 weeks, the total was revised to more than 5,700. These staggering numbers may partly reflect the region's struggle to adapt to rising temperatures. Air conditioning remains relatively rare, even though Europe is the fastest warming continent on Earth. But they also showed the wider impact of heat that is likely missing from U.S. counts. Konstantinoudis said, having these statistics on hand during the summer rather than months after the fact can motivate people to take heat risks more seriously. They can also spur governments to adapt. After deaths in Italy last year, several regional governments instituted bans on outdoor work during the hottest part of the day. Studying excess mortality also allows researchers to assess how climate change influenced a heat wave's human cost. In a recent analysis of deaths in England and Wales, Konstantinoudis and colleagues modeled the relationship between temperature and mortality based on historical data, then used their findings to estimate how many more people died during the June heat wave than would have if the disaster happened in a pre-industrial world. They found the daytime maximum temperatures in the regions are 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, which is 5.4 to 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit, higher because of planet warming pollution, most of which comes from burning fossil fuels. That extra heat accounted for 38% of the deaths during the June heat wave, which was more than 800 people. This gives us an important argument for climate mitigation, Konstantinoudis said, because we can now see the actual toll. Our second news article for the Washington Post from Berlin, submitted by Mary Ilyushina and Sammy Westfall. The fugitive suspect in a deadly attack on the Berlin Pride Parade was killed in a police operation on Sunday, authorities said. Berlin police said the suspect was found in a garden in the western Berlin borough of Spandau around 6 p.m. Sunday, about 20 hours after the attack. There, he reportedly ran toward emergency forces with a stabbing weapon. The officers then opened fire and shot him. Firefighters tried to resuscitate him, but he died at the scene. A van rammed into crowds of partygoers in the city's center's sprawling Tiergarten Park on Saturday as they celebrated Christopher Street Day, Berlin's oldest pride event. The crash killed a woman and injured at least 29 people, according to authorities, who said the driver fled afterwards. The Christopher Street Pride event is named after the New York street that was the site of the 1969 Stonewall riots, which sparked the modern gay rights movement. The celebration draws tens of thousands of people every year. Earlier Sunday, police released a photograph of the suspect, a 21-year-old Abdul B., describing him as slim, around 6'2", with black hair. His last name was withheld in accordance with German privacy laws. Quote, everything we see here points to an Islamist terrorist attack, end quote, Interior Minister Alexander Dobrindt said. The suspect had undergone radicalization and belonged to the Islamist scene, Dobrindt said. He added that the suspect was a German national with Lebanese roots who was born in Germany in 2004. His mother was naturalized as a German citizen in 2002. The Berlin Public Prosecutor's Office confirmed earlier media reports that the suspect had allegedly developed the desire to join the armed struggle of Islam and of ISIS, made a failed attempt to travel to Syria to join the militant group, and made contact with individuals in Lebanon he believed were members of the group. ISIS refers to the Islamic State. In Lebanon, he was sentenced to 3 months in prison for incitement to religious and sectarian conflict, among other things, the prosecutor's office said. After serving that sentence, he returned to Germany in November, where he was arrested at the Berlin International Airport. He spent 6 months in pretrial detention in the country. According to Dobrindt, the attacker on Saturday had used some kind of blade, presumably a machete, to assault bystanders after ramming the car. An extensive nationwide manhunt was launched, with police scouring train stations, airports, and border crossings. The attack rattled Berlin's robust LGBTQ plus community and abruptly ended a celebration that had gone off peacefully, with participants marching through the street for hours, dancing to techno music, and cheering the dozens of floats in the parade. Organizers canceled the rest of events on Saturday, and the site of the attack has been under lockdown with investigators gathering evidence. More than 2,200 officers had been on duty in Berlin since Saturday morning to protect the parade and other pride events, according to Reuters. Quote, hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world were peacefully celebrating at Christopher Street Day. They wanted us to treat each other with kindness and tolerance, end quote, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said early Sunday. We are open and freedom-loving, and we will preserve and defend that, he said, pledging that the attack would be investigated and pursued with the utmost severity. Kai Wegner, Berlin's mayor, wrote that it was an attack on the city's free and open society. A peaceful and colorful CSD, the Assembly for a Tolerant and Peaceful Berlin, was attacked in the most brutal way, the mayor said on X. Berlin is the city of freedom, and our freedom has been attacked in the most horrific way today. In a later statement, Wegner said that there was a, quote, high level of security, end quote, at the event, and that the festival site itself was not attacked because the perpetrator wasn't able to make it there because that had been secured by police. The attack occurred on one of the paths leading up to the event site, about a quarter of a mile from the main activities, he added. By Sunday afternoon, scores of people with pride flags flocked to the Brandenburg Gate in order to hold a vigil. The attack reignited Germany's long-running debate about migration and religious extremism, and it comes a few weeks ahead of closely watched regional elections in which the far-right Alternative for Germany, or the AfD, is the front-runner. The AfD campaigns on mass deportations, closing Germany's border to undocumented migration and what it calls re-migration, and its leaders have long framed Islam as incompatible with German society. The party has often moved quickly to capitalize on previous attacks, holding what it billed as a memorial rally in Magdeburg 3 days after the 2024 Christmas market attack there. Germany has faced several attacks attributed to Islamist extremists in recent years, including the killing of a police officer at an anti-Islam rally in Mannheim in 2024 and a knife attack at a street festival in Solingen 3 months later that killed three people and was claimed by the Islamic State militant group. Vehicle rammings have been a recurring extremist tactic in Europe since the Islamic State began promoting them a decade ago. Researchers have documented several dozen such attacks worldwide since 2000, and Germany has been on alert for them since a truck was driven into a Christmas market at Breitscheidplatz in Berlin in 2016, killing 12 people. The deadliest remains the 2016 attack in Nice, France, where a 19-ton truck was driven into crowds watching Bastille Day fireworks, killing 86 people and injuring more than 400. Now a reading from the Post's section called The Optimist. You want a good life? Try Nonna Maxing with these Italian grandmothers. We spoke to nonnas and other experts about their best tips for la dolce vita. As they roll fresh orecchiette at a bakery in southern Italy, Grazia in Campo, 90, and Teresa Calia, 88, look more like lifelong pasta makers than social media stars. The best friends who have known each other since they were children have become unlikely wellness influences for Nonna Maxing. This is a social media trend that celebrates living like an Italian grandmother, always having a friend nearby, throwing away almost nothing, and finding countless uses for olive oil. The craze, which has simmered like delicious ragu for months, also centers on home-cooked food, time spent gossiping together, light activity like tending heirloom tomatoes, and importantly, embracing the aging process. Short clips on social media show Encampo and Kalia singing and laughing as they create oversized dishes. In one video, they attempt to, quote, cut their alcohol intake, with Encampo frantically snipping with scissors as Kalia pours a generous glass of wine. Curious about their outlook on life and newfound fame, we spoke to some Italian nonners and experts about their best tips for La Dolce Vita. Home-cooked food made with love. Encampo and Kalia are the brains behind the traditional recipes at Antico Forna Santa Caterina in the town of Altamura in southern Italy. The pair have amassed legions of fans for their cheeky humor as much as their giant servings of pasta and breads laden with fresh cheeses, meat, tomato, and, of course, olive oil. Their lightheartedness and passion for food shows why nonnas have captivated the internet and been deployed to charm crowds of tourists with their presence. Bakery co-owner Giacomo Barattini, a distant relative of Encampo, said he sought her advice on preserving traditional recipes for bread, focaccia, and cookies, and showcasing the authentic Italian dishes the region had to offer. "I like homemade pasta very much," Encampo told the Washington Post as she sat under a cool arch preparing lunch for the following day. "Always made with our own hands. Bread, too. One should never lack good bread. Even when it's old, it's delicious. We don't throw anything away. We'll make use of it." Susanna Mills, a National Health Service consultant and public health and clinical fellow at Newcastle University in the United Kingdom, said the post-war generation typically had a stronger connection to the food they ate, with people more likely to grow, wash, and cook their own vegetables. The benefits of home cooking are well documented, as it tends to be lower in sodium, saturated fats, and proportioned smaller than restaurant or takeout food. For Elda Cirizzotti, an 86-year-old nonna who moved to Toronto from Italy in 1966, homemade food is non-negotiable. "I like to feed people," Cirizzotti said in an interview. Her granddaughter, Alessandra Urechina, runs her website and social media accounts where Cirizzotti dishes out tips including how to keep strawberries fresh and prepare snails to eat. Quote, "Once you have potato, flour, oil, you have everything. You can make anything you want," Cirizzotti says. Her diet consists of everything from pasta to beans to lentils, potatoes, vegetables, and meat. Food restrictions are out when non-maxing. Cirizzotti uses traditional recipes from the Circolaria region outside of Rome, which were once used by her grandmother to make dishes like gnocchi, lasagna, and tomato-based sauces. This approach is something Urechina has absorbed into her own cooking, where she focuses on ingredients including dried pastas, home-canned tomatoes, eggs, and seasonal vegetables. She uses these to make Italian-style dishes such as pastas, frittatas, and sautéed vegetables, and said her nonna would always make a minestrone soup for clearing out unused produce at the end of the week. Making your own food is so much easier and more accessible and healthier when you understand the basics of that kind of Italian cooking, Urechina said. Strong social connections are linked to health benefits, feeling happier, and even lowering the risk of cognitive decline, with research showing that people are often happier being with others. Encampo and Kalia seem to be the embodiment of this, holding court in the bakery on everything from love to health problems for those who drop by. "They never watch TV and they never stay alone," Barattini said. "They talk about happiness, they talk about love, they talk about everything, and they teach us the life philosophy every day." Encampo says she advises family to love and care for one another and that we should always carry on, even if the younger generation doesn't want to hear it. "Nowadays, it is difficult to advise youngsters on what to do after a long life, as they won't even listen to their parents or anyone else," she said. "You need to work. Listen to your parents, grandparents too, aunts and uncles. We do provide them with a few tips." Staring into the Tuscan countryside and lightly tending in her herb garden looks dreamy, but make no mistake, most nonnas labored hard throughout their lives and still do. "I like work," said Cirizzotti, who moved to Canada at age 26 and raised three children while working various jobs, including making shoes in a stockings factory and in a care home. "When I move here, I fly like a bird," Cirizzotti said about the transition from post-war Italy. "We didn't have..."
Okay, we're back, and just so you know, you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LEB Radio. Paul is reading today's Lowell Sun. I'm David. I'm reading yesterday, the Sunday Lowell Sun. And who's supposed to lead off here, Paul?
I think it's me? You were reading the...
Paul doesn't...
You were reading the Rosie's Diner stuff?
Okay, so I should lead off then, all right? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. Now that you're talking into the microphone, I can hear you better.
Yep, there you go.
Let's see now. Here's something that I should be listening to when I'm reading, okay? Because Paul will say, absolutely. Here is the article. Help wanted in Drake It.
Oh.
Here we go. I'm a Drake It resident. As Drake It town manager Kate Hodges has reminded residents on several occasions today, the town is losing employees. Why are we losing employees? That's due to salaries that are not competitive what nearby towns can offer, and the layoffs caused by the same budget crisis keeping paychecks low. Well, okay. Right now, two key positions are listed. Paul, listen up. You might, you know, this could be of interest to you.
Okay, we'll see.
As are open on the town's website. One is for the position of finance director. I could do that. The assistant town manager title is missing. They just want a finance director. I could handle that. I could just say, hey, fellas, you're spending more than you're taking in. How's that? You think I get hired? Just say, fellas, you're spending more than you take in.
I wish it was that simple.
Huh?
I wish it was that simple.
That is a vacancy created by the recent departure of Catherine Foster. The second position, okay, maybe you'd be interested in this one, is that of a library director. That would not be my strength. It has been open since February when Christine Muir left for an equivalent position in Plastow, New Hampshire. New Jersey. Muir worked as the Parker Memorial Library in Drake It for 4 years, coming from Lexington, where she was the assistant director of the Carey Memorial Library. She was hired in Drake It as assistant director, but became director shortly afterward. She organized the Lexington Library's 150th anniversary celebration and the Drake It Library's 100th celebration. When off the clock in Drake It, she provided some quiet guidance to St. Anne's Church in Lowell for its 200th anniversary in 2024-25. Librarians aren't just for books and videos anymore. Muir recognized the potential of the Library of the Things movement and expanded what her predecessors had started. Library cardholders can borrow a host of items from lawn games. Did you know you could rent lawn? Not rent, but borrow lawn games? That's one. Power tools. Really? Power tools?
Well, didn't know that.
Appliances, digital film scanners, tools for crafts, and more. The library is open to anyone 18 or older who holds a Merrimack Valley Consortium library card. I do hold the card. I'm sure you do, too,
yeah,
Paul.
I do.
So you could go get there. You could go there and get power tools, digital film scanners. You could get a whole bunch of stuff there. Who knew? When this reporter told Brian Flaherty, chair of the Board of Library Trustees, that Muir will be missed, he replied, for sure, she was wonderful. Applications for the position were originally set to close on April 6th, but the search continues. So you were supposed to get in your application by the 6th, but it's going to continue. So to me, that suggests they didn't get any qualified applicants. The board is reviewing resumes and hopes to have a new director on board soon. So so that's the article about Drake It. And, nope, I'm retired. I'm not interested. So, let's see. I'll send it back to you, Paul.
Okay, so... A little bit of a follow-up to that article about the election law changes. And I think people should be aware of the fact that in the election this November, there are going to be nine ballot questions, including the one that I mentioned about Election Day. But I'll mention a couple more which could be of interest, which might be of interest to listeners if they are going to vote on these issues. There's question six, which is create natural resource conservation fund. And this would place a sales tax revenue from sporting goods like golf clubs, RVs, and camping gear into a new Nature for All fund that sponsors say could generate $100 million annually for water and nature conservation and restoration efforts. The next one is to do with question seven, is single-family homes.
Wait. So in other words, if I buy golf clubs, I'm going to pay more than 6.25% sales tax?
No, it's just that the revenue from that tax revenue will go into this fund.
Oh, so it's not increasing my
sales
tax.
No, it's not increasing. It's just
I have no say on where this money goes anyway, right?
Anyway, but somebody's putting this on the ballot for people to vote on.
Okay, all right.
It's quite interesting. But the next one, of course, is another old story about housing. And it's question seven, single-family homes. And this would make it easier for residents to purchase a home by updating zoning rules, including allowing single-family homes to be built in a residentially zoned area as long as the land on which it is to be constructed is at least 5,000 square feet and has at least 50 feet of land bordering the street, road, or public way that it faces, and also has access to public sewer and water services. The question eight, and I know that you're deeply concerned about this, David, is prohibit the retail sale of adult recreational use marijuana. Would repeal the current laws that legalize, regulate, and tax the retail sale of adult recreational use of marijuana. And this is really interesting because they just passed that bill a few years ago, and now they want to scrap it.
Yeah, so do you want to give me your position on that, or you don't want to reveal it?
I don't really bother with marijuana, so...
I don't think it's good for society.
No.
Okay?
I just feel that I thought that the people won't vote for this because by taxing it, you're getting sin tax money, and the state's getting it to spend it on, I think it's supposed to spend it on schools and roads and stuff. So, but it's pretty interesting that it's already under threat. And then, of course, two other questions, which I have read about this before, and I think it's kind of whimsical, but anyway. One of them is to make asparagus the official state vegetable.
Oh, I'm okay with that. Yeah, okay. I'm good with that. What the heck, you know.
And it says, the House on a vote without a roll call gave initial approval to a bill requested by some third grade students at Hadley Elementary School to make asparagus the official state vegetable.
Fine, I'm good.
Other areas in the nation are also working to designate their state as the asparagus capital of the world. Asparagus is woven into the history of the Pioneer Valley, and Hadley grass once supplied 80% of the nation's crop, says Homer Gomez, a Democrat from East Hampton. And designating it as the official state vegetable honors the farmers who built that legacy and gives Massachusetts growers a marketing edge. The same way state fruit status has boosted our cranberry industry. And I'm especially proud that this effort was driven by Hadley third graders, whose civic engagement shows exactly why this recognition matters. When a classroom filled with passionate third graders advocates for asparagus to become the official state vegetable, I listen closely, said Senator Joe Comerford from Northampton. And it was inspiring to meet with these students at Hadley Elementary School as they shared the history and regional significance of asparagus. I am grateful to these young people for reminding us how democracy works. And the last one here, which I know is relatable to you, I think, David, is to do with the official state crustacean. The House gave initial approval to a bill that would make the American lobster the official state crustacean. This bill is about celebrating and uplifting a significant sector of the state's blue economy, our historic maritime culture, and a sustainable fishery, said House sponsor Joan Massino, a Democrat from Hull. I am glad to file this bill in partnership with the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association and held to honor a crucial industry in the Commonwealth. The American lobster is an iconic part of Massachusetts' coastal identity, heritage, and the economy, said Patrick O'Connor, a Republican from Weymouth. Designating it as our official state crustacean recognizes the generations of fishermen and coastal communities whose livelihoods have been built around this remarkable species and celebrates an industry that remains part of the soul of the Commonwealth. So, there you go. What about the poor old crabs?
I mean, if that results in the lobster prices coming down, I'm all for
okay.
it.
Okay, I don't think
that. I mean, so you said there are going to be 9 ballot questions?
9, that's a big
number. So when I go to cast my ballot, I'm going to have some guy that has in front of me that hasn't read any of this beforehand, and it'll be in there for a half hour.
Reading.
And I could see the coin going up in the air, flipping the coin, whether, do I vote for this or not, you know.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, all right, I got something more interesting than this, all right? This is very interesting, and I know you're going to listen. Here's the question. Is it better to adopt a male or a female cat? This is important, you know. Okay. Let's see.
How about neither?
Which is better to adopt, a tomcat or a queen cat? Tomcat versus queen cat. I didn't. Did you know that a tomcat is a male?
Yes.
You did. Okay, I did. And a queen cat, I guess, is a female.
I didn't know that.
Okay. For folks who love cats, I guess that doesn't include you.
No.
This is a rich topic for discussion. And this question prompted, you should see the size of the article. This is not like a paragraph. And this question prompted a variety of responses, the majority of which said that the male cats were preferred. Now we're going to have to find out why, right? You know what? We're going to get letters coming into the Blind Association now if we say that we prefer male cats, you know? Okay, reasons for the choice range from more loving, true sense of humor. A cat has a true sense of humor?
What are they talking about?
Affectionate. Is any cat that you know affectionate?
Not really.
Lovey-dovey, cuddly, and so on. Females were described as very assertive, great hunters, more standoffish, talking, looking for attention. Now, they better not be talking about my wife like that, you know. However, plenty of respondents noted that their female cats could be very affectionate, intelligent, and playful. That attributes any cat owner would love to see in their feline. And here is where I propose another consideration. Number of cats in the household. How many could you take, Paul?
0.
That's not one of the answers. Long, long ago, before the internet, after push-button phones, I grew up in Lunenburg. Our family started with 1 male cat, but by the time my brother Hal and I were in kindergarten and second grade, our mother consented to adding a pair of kittens. October, a female, and Sam, a male, I guess that's the name, October, to the mix. My mom realized she needed a kitten of her own. And since there were farms aplenty, we soon had 4 cats where we added nonsense, another female. You mentioned naming your cat named Nonsense or October. Do you think a cat responds to that name?
Well, if you say it often enough.
I don't think so. Dogs do.
Yeah.
You know. With four cats, the word got out, and before long, our relatives in Pittsburgh were telling us about a stray cat who needed homes. Next came Henry, Ashley, and Nicodemus, all male. Lo and behold, the spraying began. The spraying? What does that mean, spraying? Are they talking about from their mouth or from...
Is it spaying or...
No, it's a spray.
Spray?
Lo and behold, the spraying began. So off to Dr. Fitzgerald to get the males fixed. The spray, they're just peeing, I guess. They're marking their place, but, of course, both October and Nonsense had a litter of kittens and didn't get fixed right away. Are these rabbits? Before long, we didn't have millions of cats, as Wanda Gag wrote about in her book from 1928, but we had plenty, so many that a couple of cats decided to move in with neighbors who were fine with their arrivals. Can you imagine your neighbor that probably has like 20 cats and they're outside and, well, you're not going to have any birds around your house, right?
No, or mice.
Oh, I didn't think of that. Maybe that's a good idea. Can I rent one of those cats?
Downstairs you can.
Huh?
Downstairs.
By the mid-70s, we were early adopters of the Fix All Your Cats program, but the strays kept coming. We averaged six cats occasionally. Eight or more, since my mother could never resist a free kitten sign nailed to a telephone pole. There was a barn attached to our house, so the cats had their choices about having shelter and catching, mice, moles, snakes, or being truly indoors. Over the years, my brother and I estimated there must have been more than 50 cats that came and went at our house over a span of 20 years. They all got along, played together, and had individual personalities. Our recollections are that they were all, save for an accidental feral cat, happened to be lap cats, especially in the winter. Ultimately, whether it's better to have a male or female cat is dependent on one question. Which cat do you respond to? And I hope you ask the question at a rescue or shelter where the cats have been fixed, vaccinated, and have had their temperaments evaluated. Their temperaments are evaluated. What do we hire?
Psychiatrists
to check them out? So I think I would just say, can I just get a cat that will obey me, right, and not be independent, right? Like a dog.
Yeah.
And will come when I say come.
Yeah.
There aren't going to be any, right?
I don't think so.
No. All right. All right. Back to you.
Okay. Okay, so some international news here is kind of interesting. It's in Europe, and it says that wildfires in France drives 250,000 people from their homes. That's a huge number. A raging wildfire in southwest France forced the evacuation of 55,000 people overnight Sunday, bringing the total number forced out of their homes to a staggering 220,000 in one region alone. As these flames have crept closer to the wine region of Bordeaux, shifting and gusting winds as well as arid conditions complicated massive efforts to limit the spread of the monster blaze burning out of control in France's Gironde region where Bordeaux is located. Authorities issued overnight evacuation orders for five more locality southwest of the historic city. The situation remains very unfavorable, Laurent Nunez says for the French government, after he described another difficult night for firefighters battling around the clock against the blaze. The fire became virulent again, unpredictable, generated its own winds, and is advancing towards the Bordeaux metropolitan area. And then in another headline, it says the Pope calls for prayers for the victims of these fires. At the end of his Sunday Angelus prayer, Pope Leo XIV referenced the devastating wildfires in France and Spain and said, "I express my solidarity and invite everyone to pray for those affected and for the work of the rescue workers." An estimated 162 square miles has burned in the Gironde region. Much of it forests and scrubland, which had been made tinder dry by successive heat waves. And that is seven times the area of Manhattan Island and four times the size of Paris. Firefighters raced in trucks to fight flare-ups, and planes are dropping water and retardants into the smoke-filled air. Farmers delivered water and tanks to fire crews so they could fight the flames without interruption. And this allows firefighters to focus on the fire, said Theo Hernandez, a wine grower. The number of firefighters mobilized grew to 2,500, backed by 18 planes and helicopters, and some help from other European nations. This blade has created virulent firestorms, it said. In a first for France, the blaze alarmingly developed into a self-feeding firestorm on several occasions, most recently on Saturday night, generating lightning bolts that can start new flare-ups. I never heard of this. It's like being confronted by a hurricane, said the Gironde Fire Chief Mark Vermeulen. Forecast high temperatures starting on Tuesday could complicate this matter. And no evacuees will be allowed back into their towns and villages until this is all taken care of. The mayor of Bordeaux, Thomas Cazenave, described the blaze as being at the gates of the metropolitan area, which is about 9 miles. But he said that an evacuation of Bordeaux is not on the cards. And this is a city which is home to 268,000 people. And the last part of this is to do with Spain. Tens of thousands of people were forced out of their homes in Spain. In Spain, wildfires burned out of control around Madrid, which is the capital city. Evacuations were also carried out Sunday in the Valencia area. A man was killed in a wildfire in a suburb of Valencia, marking Spain's first recorded death in the fires. "We still have some difficult hours ahead," says Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez on Sunday, "but the night was very positive in terms of bringing the flames under control." A total of 76,000 have been evacuated in Spain, while 30,000 others have been confined to their homes. Evacuees fretted about what they'll find when they're alerted to return home. "It looked like the apocalypse. You couldn't see anything. Everything was covered in ash," says Rocio Dominguez, who evacuated with her dog Simba from a place called Chepinera, west of Madrid. "We don't know when we get to the town if we'll have half the house burned down or we'll have it intact or we won't have a house," she said. "All the clothes, all the memories, everything." So, what a disaster.
Absolutely sad. Yeah. Okay. Here comes another important one for you, Paul. Okay. Giant skeletons are staying up year-round across L.A. This is talking about Halloween. You ever go by a house and you see the giant skeletons?
Oh, the giant ones, yeah.
Well, they stay up all year.
Oh, some people, keep them up, yeah.
Yeah, okay. The undead are invading L.A., okay? They wear Santa hats. They wear Santa hats and sunglasses. This is the skeletons, the giant skeletons. Okay, so they wear Santa hats and sunglasses, American flags and pool floaties. Some stand erect, towering over houses in the neighborhood. Others rot in the California sun, disintegrating into bony fragments. A pelvis atop two legs in a driveway. A skull peering over a rooftop. They are, of course, giant 12-foot skeletons. And if they're not in your neighborhood already, there probably will be soon. Would you want one of your neighbors to have, be walking your neighborhood and you see them?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I would just think how cheesy.
Yeah.
You know, just.
All year.
Released by Home Depot in 2020, so there's who you can blame. Okay? The Halloween prop known as Skelly has transmogrified from a meme into a movement. At first, mostly limited to the month of October and maybe a week or two in November, many skeletons now stay up year-round as their proud owners deck them with whatever theme fits the latest holidays, Christmas, Easter, the 4th of July, etc. Some are political. I didn't know that. A Putin skeleton puppeteering an undead Trump. Really? In other words, the face is Trump
face.
Or Putin?
Yeah.
Or a skeleton with a sign that says, not vaccinated. I like that one. Not vaccinated. Because I'm kind of a pro-vaccine guy. You know what I mean? That's just me.
Yeah.
I even said to my wife yesterday, I haven't had a COVID vaccine lately. I probably should go get one.
We've moved on to something else.
What's that?
We've all moved on to other problems.
Joke. Not vaccinated. See you some idiots. That's what it says. Not vaccinated. See you some idiots. Others are the subject of fights with cities and homeowners associations. Oh, now, you know, if you're in a condo, you can't be putting this stuff up.
Can't be putting
in up. L.A., they're everywhere. Highland Park, Venice, Culver City, Westchester, Burbank, Pasadena, Hollywood, and beyond. They're loved, they're hated, and they're a natural byproduct of Los Angeles, a city filled with creative and the bohemian, with people who want to make a splash, get a laugh, or simply get noticed. But there's another uniquely LA reason why the more and more skeletons are becoming permanent yard fixtures. They're too big to put away.
That's the reason.
Yeah, where do you store them?
How do you take them apart? You need a big ladder.
As home prices skyrocket, storage space becomes a luxury. Backyards hold ADUs, you know, accessory dwelling units. Large closets become bedrooms. Giant skeletons stand for 365 days a year for the same reason that pianos, treadmills, and couches are given away for free. They're too big to do anything else with. Better up than in. Better up than in. Okay, better up standing up than
standing
inside.
Up.
Home Depot made a plastic storage bin. Oh, Home Depot built a plastic storage bin specifically for the skeletons. But even the storage bins are huge, says Tyler Bradbury. For Bradbury, who works in visual arts, the skeleton is an extension of the inside of his home, where maximalism reigns with psychedelic art, push head, I don't know what that is, H.R. Geiger, neck face, etc., and a life-size E.T. statue. Everything is so sterile now. Everyone wants their house to look like a square box, he said. It's nice for things to stick out a bit. Weird stuff gives the neighbors something to talk about. The only thing I would talk about is I would say, what jerk is living in that house?
Right? Yeah, this guy.
You don't have one of those, do you,
little,
before I say any more?
No, I don't believe in any of those.
Okay. At least one neighbor has had a bone to pick. An older man from Central America who told him he was playing with death. Oh, you know. For Christmas, Bradbury dressed the skeleton as Santa Claus with a 6-foot beard. For a haunted frat-themed birthday party, he gave it a toga. I mean, really, do people have real lives?
Apparently not.
In 2023, he went viral for digitally editing a pair of comically large Junko jeans on the skeleton, J-N-C-O. Shortly after, with the help of two friends who work in wardrobe design, he brought the meme to life, debuting a skeleton with billowing denim at the L.A. Culture Festival, whatever that is. Chief Keefe thought it was hilarious, he said. In Atwater Village, photographer Lexi Bonin has had hers up since 2020. I don't want her as my neighbor. What started as a 12-foot skeleton beaten by years of wind and rain has withered into a 6-foot pelvis on two legs. So the top part of the body's gone. I'm in the house with the legs. She lives near the L.A. River Trail, so plenty of passerbys take pictures. Bonham tried taking it down last year, but as soon as she did, a father and a son drove by to see it and expressed their dismay that it was gone. People were upset, but when we brought it back for Halloween, everyone was stoked. What kind of people live there that get stoked looking at that? Businesses are joining the movement as well. Above the VCA Burbank Animal Hospital, a skeleton named R.I.P. Lay, reminds incoming pet owners of their pet's mortality. Manager Dunn said it went up last October as a reward for 100% of employees completing a survey on workplace culture, but now it's a neighborhood staple. I don't know. It's been a great way to connect with the community. We've become known as the hospital with the skeleton. Bruce Dow, who lives in the Central Valley city of Turlock, said people drive by his skeleton named the skeleton's name is Mr. Bones. Now, how original is that, you know? Mr. Bones. You know, that we could have a contest. You know, what would be the best name? Out at lunch a few months ago, a stranger recognized me as the skeleton guy. Maybe you should do something like that. For Father's Day, Dow Skeleton grilled. Dow spray painted an inflatable swimming pool black for our barbecue and asked his mom to sew a giant apron. Dow is a member of the 12-foot skeleton Halloween club. I never knew it. They have a club. Do you believe that?
I do believe it.
No, you don't. A 12-foot skeleton Halloween club?
I do. I believe it.
You do. We should YouTube that.
Yeah, I'm telling you. It's
A Facebook group with more than... You want to guess how many members they have?
How many members? Let's see. Well, these things are all over. 200,000?
Well, you know, yours is just as wild as the number here, 64,000. I'm like,
oh my goodness.
Would you even admit that you're part of it?
Look around you in society today, David. Does it surprise you?
64,000 members where people share their own designs and stories. Can you imagine they get all excited? They're showing what... designs and stories they could have for their 12-foot skeleton. Yeah. A skeleton melting after a house... Oh, wait a minute. Uh-oh. A skeleton melting after a house fire or a stolen skull tracked down by the police. Can you imagine someone taking the skull off? You know, you got to get the police involved in that.
Oh, my God.
That's big stuff. You know what? That's going to end it. That's foolishness in these papers. So we want to thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen. No, they're not. There are only three ways to listen to our radio station. One is to request a free specialized radio receiver. And if you want one, I don't know if we have any left, but call us at the lab at 978-454-5704. Another way to listen is dial this phone number, 1-631-359-9069. And the third way, which I assume is the best way, is go to our website, LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. I want to thank Paul once again for putting up with reading all these important news articles to the listeners. Paul,
yeah, well, let's hope Mr. Bones is okay.
Mr. Bones. 12-foot skeletons, you know. Can you imagine I come home and I say to Donna, I think I'd like to get one of those. She'd say to me, there's the front door.
Yeah.
Leave, you know.
And some people just love to do these decorations at Christmas and Halloween.
Or
and,
annoy their neighbors.
Or, well, yeah, well, that's... Especially if somebody's got, like, thousands upon thousands of Christmas lights. Can you imagine how bright it must be if you live across the street?
Yeah, yeah, I got you. I got you. So, Paul, thank you. Thank you, listeners.
All right, thank you, everybody.
All right.
Have a good week.
All right, we rebroadcast at 4. And tomorrow, new news being read by different volunteers at 9 in the morning. Bye-bye for now. And back to Marshfield Broadcasting.
If there's anything better than being smart, it's being kind. And reaffirming that every day is our method of making sure her chin never drops. My dad wasn't around, and I remember...